is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Bay Area Guy. Bay Area Guy, great having you back on the show.
It's great to be back on.
And I'm also joined with Alex Von Goldstein.
Great to be on, guys, and Robert, it's always a pleasure.
Bay Area Guy, just kind of following things up, you're basically like, Bay Area Guy, basically, so you're the only Bernie Sanders supporter on the alt-right. That's kind of your claim to fame.
Right. Well, I don't really know if it's my claim to fame just yet, but it is something that distinguishes me from the bulk of alt-righters who more or less are diehard Trump fans. But I don't think it's anything too crazy, and I've never exactly made it a secret. I think going back to the article I wrote on the Radical Center, I made it clear that I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, and the fact that I am a radical centrist means that I don't see any contradiction between being an alt-righter and also supporting Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I've noticed that with a lot of alt-righters, they tend to, a lot of them are sympathetic to a lot of Bernie Sanders' views, but overall I'd say they favor Trump primarily because of, like, immigration issues, but a lot of them are sympathetic to aspects of Bernie Sanders.
Right, and one article I read on the alt-right by another author even flat out stated that I'd have nothing against Sanders, but of course they then add that, well, he's a socialist and he doesn't represent our views. But I think that most people of all ideological stripes recognize that something is very rotten with the state of the American economy. So I think Bernie Sanders resonates with a lot of people, even those who aren't necessarily fans.
The alt-right, there's probably also a lot of suspicion around him just for his Jewish identity and the fact that he, went to a kibbutz and all that. I'm sure, there are people who, raise their eyebrows at that.
Now, it's interesting you mention that, because one thing I will say in Sanders' defense is that of all the major presidential candidates, he was the only one who did not speak at AIPAC. Meanwhile, even Donald Trump, who I pointed this out during a podcast with Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki, but what I find fascinating is that many alt-righters who are always quick to point out disproportionate Jewish and Zionist influence, for some reason, they give Trump a pass when it comes to him kowtowing to the AIPAC crowd.
Interesting thing about that speech is it was the first time that he used a teleprompter, and it basically was like just sort of like your basic stereotypical like neocon talking points.
Right. So it makes you wonder if he's actually as independent as he claims to be.
May have seen some level of importance in passing the neocons to get the nomination. I mean, I guess people, some people might see that speech as just a means of a strategy or something.
Well, if there's one thing I've noticed about this Republican primary, it's that there are no sacred cows anymore. And if anything, the neocons have sort of been exposed as this alien interest group. And frankly, I don't think that most Republicans are sad to see them go.
And I think that is the most crucial thing about the Trump campaign. I mean, even if Trump ends up being a total charlatan, just the fact that he's like extending the Overton window and abolishing all these different sacred cows, all these different taboos, I mean, that alone is really remarkable.
Exactly. And he's basically demonstrated that your average rank-and-file white Republican doesn't really give a damn about stuff like limited government or balancing the budget or various other conservatism 101 talking points. So I think that will definitely open things up for other candidates in the future.
Well, I live up here in North Jersey, and I just see, which is like historically like a blue area, and I see so many Trump bumper stickers and signs on people's lawns, because I think a lot of, older white people have had desires for certain things, especially surrounding immigration, and I think they just wanted the chance to have it, and Trump is the guy who opened the door for that, or at least for the discussion of it.
Right. And another thing that he's also done is that he is probably the only Republican in recent memory to speak out against free trade and channel certain populist sentiments. And I know Robert Lint sent an article to me about Trump running to the left of Hillary Clinton, and on issues such as free trade, which the majority of Americans now hate, and on issues such as foreign policy and warmongering, Trump is to the left of Hillary Clinton in many regards. So definitely.
And that's what his parallels with Sanders are there in those two factors.
Right. And what's even more interesting is that he has been going out of his way to praise Bernie Sanders, saying that he's been unfairly attacked by the DNC and that he should maybe run his own campaign and show them, and that he's right on issues such as trade. So you can clearly see that he's going to try to pivot somewhat to the left in order to win disaffected Sanders supporters. And he's even openly stated his intent in that regard.
Because basically in the primary, he has to be kind of careful to find the right balance, because he does need to win over at least a significant number of conservatives to get the nomination. But once he gets the nomination, then I kind of see him going more in a radical centrist direction, as you were saying. And as the article said, he's even sort of basically reneged his tax position. A while back, this was when he was running for president in 2000. He was thinking about running for president. I mean, massive increase in taxation on the wealthy to pay off the deficit. Then he early on flirted with, he said, I'm going to tax Wall Street. Then he came out with his official tax plan, which called for a tax cut on the rich. And then now he's kind of saying maybe we should raise taxes on the wealthy. So, yeah, I mean, he's flip-flopping and playing the game. But it's interesting to see the course that he's taking. And I know some people are very idealistic, and they don't like it when they can't respect or support a politician who flip-flops. But, I mean, if you kind of put that aside, what is for the type of the ideas that he's bringing together and influencing ideas and movements in the future?
Right, and I think that a lot of people are also willing to overlook these flip-flops because many surveys have shown that Trump supporters are not especially ideological. Only a small minority describe themselves as very conservative. Some are moderate. Some are semi-conservative. What they really are doing with Trump is it's basically a big middle finger to the establishment, and they want to shake things up. And what's funny about that is that so many Republicans, and even Hillary Clinton now, have been trying to derail Trump by sort of quoting establishment figures who don't like him. So they're kind of swinging an axe at their own feet.
And there was massive crossover in the primaries in Pennsylvania and a number of other northeastern states. There were a significant number of Democrats who were crossing over to vote for Trump. And there was an article, it was either Red State or National Review, but I'll link to it, and it said that Trump Democrats are taking over the Republican Party and how they're dangerous because they're going to destroy, like, conservative principles.
When are these people going to realize that nobody really cares about conservative principles? I think these people just can't accept the fact that they're being rendered irrelevant.
Yeah, we're basically seeing
yeah.
sort of the beginning of the end of kind of conservative ink, which really got its start with, like, Buckley. And basically, the so-called conservative movement, what it was a coalition of fiscal interests, business interests, who are primarily concerned for less taxes and regulations, foreign policy hawks, and then the religious right. And Trump doesn't – what's remarkable about Trump is he doesn't really fit into any of those categories. And even Breitbart, which is the number one conservative website, is starting, even they are starting to go in a more kind of a different direction away from Conservative Inc.
Well, I think the problem with Conservatism Inc. is you mentioned that coalition, and basically the Republican Party is a party by and for the wealthy primarily, but they were able to bring in the religious right and other types via wedge issues such as abortion, affirmative action. But the problem is that they've been losing on those issues. Gay marriage is now legal. The religious right has virtually no influence anymore. So I think since they can't even win on those issues, the increasingly angry base is saying, well, what good are these guys?
It's funny to think about how, these people are, quote unquote conservatives, but they come from this, neoliberal background that is a leftist idea, like an early 20th century leftist idea of bringing forth equality through industrializing the world. So they're just these really old school leftists.
Right. And that's actually a point one commenter on the blog Alternative Right made in response to one of my articles posted there. He basically said, well, what exactly are they conserving? They don't care if these libertarian types who write for Conservatism Inc. publications such as The Federalist, they mainly focus on defending untrammeled capitalism, which is basically a classical liberal position. So what exactly is conservative about their whole ideology?
And they become more and more liberal every year, it seems. I mean, reading National Review, a lot of the time it seems like you're reading a leftist paper from, the 60s or something.
They always seem to contradict themselves, because with Trump, it's either Trump is either too liberal or he's too much of a right-wing extremist. Like they attack him for both, for being both at the same simultaneously. It's just absurd.
Well, they get him on the liberal fascist thing, like the Jonah Goldberg.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
he's like big government, and he's also
article about the Trump Democrats that I reference, basically they're saying Trump supporters are like racist old school Democrats who are for social programs. They just want more social programs for white people. That's what the article said.
Well, and what's funny about that is that if it weren't for these racist Democrats, then the Republicans would have never won the solid South in the first place. So what's kind of funny about this election is watching all these Republicans who for years have employed the dog whistle Southern strategy, or who gave us George W. Bush, are now suddenly screaming about bigotry and incompetence. And I think their real objection to Trump ultimately stems from the fact that they can't control him. They could control puppets like Bush.
I was just going to say,
exactly.
He doesn't play by the politically correct card. And I think that's a huge problem for them, because that was their legitimacy. They were sort of soft political correctness, like, the way that George Bush would talk about Islam after 9/11.
Right. Well, there's actually a hilarious Twitter account. I don't know if you're aware of it. It's called Conservative Pundit. He basically parodies mainstream conservative talking points. And he was actually interviewed by the Daily Caller, and the argument that he made was that the problem with today's conservatism is that they basically accept various leftist premises or whatever, and essentially they agree with the notion that the U.S. prior to the Civil Rights Movement was this horribly racist, spiteful place, and yet they then want us to accept the cultural and political values from that frightful era, and it's not a winning position.
So we kind of went over Trump, and the impact that Trump has had on the conservative movement and Republican Party. But the other trend that we've noticed is that there is an ongoing civil war on the left as well. And
right.
That's kind of what I'd like to kind of focus on, because with Trump, on a lot of shows, I've already sort of covered the same theme. And with this sort of ongoing civil war on the left, it's something that does get touched upon, but not to the same degree. So I think there's the political sphere of this. There's the Bernie Sanders versus Clinton thing. We can make the connection a little bit to the California Senate race, which we've been covering on the show. And then there's that article that you posted that I sent to you about San Francisco, which also ties in with this topic.
Right. And one thing about this election is that for a while, the leftist coalition was able to hold together because neoliberal identitarians such as Barack Obama were the norm, and the kind of social democracy offered by Bernie Sanders was never really on the table, or it was associated with these fringe spoilers such as Ralph Nader. But now that Sanders actually emerged as a viable candidate, a lot of mainstream liberals and establishment liberal journalists and these various neoliberal publications such as Vox, they have been in full attack mode, denouncing Sanders' single-payer health care plan, impugning the motives of Bernie Sanders supporters, the infamous Bernie bro slander, and they've basically been revealing that at the end of the day, they want to preserve the status quo, and they will often shamelessly employ social justice rhetoric in order to do so. And this has many more left-leaning, socialist-leaning progressives sort of giving the side eye to mainstream liberals.
Did you see, there's all these attacks on Sanders that use the social justice rhetoric against him. Like there was the poem he wrote in the 70s that talked about the woman wanting to be raped. And then recently there was one that was ridiculous where he told his wife to go shoo. Did you see this?
I have not.
She walked up to the mic or something while he was speaking and he said shoo. And then I saw like four or five articles saying that Bernie Sanders is a sexist. So I think there's this whole thing around Bernie where it's like, you know, we're moving forward with this, like, a progressive view of history. We got rid of the old white guys. We got a black guy. Now we're going to get a woman. And then when there is, like, the option of, like, an old, you know, white Jewish guy, it's like, well, if you pick that, you're just going back to what we had. You're sexist, you know.
It's kind of like what Clinton said is Hillary Clinton gave a speech and she said there's no point in breaking up the banks if we can't eliminate, like, racism and sexism.
Which is, of course, asinine logic, because there are plenty of things in life worth doing that won't magically end racism or sexism, and yet we still do them. So, but the fact that so many people fall for this kind of rhetoric demonstrates just how much these identity politics promoters have won among leftists. And regarding Bernie and whiteness, what's most ridiculous is that following Bernie Sanders' victory in Washington, Alaska, and Hawaii, the mainstream media basically said, oh, well, you know, Sanders, he wins in these largely white rural states. And then people were wondering, wait, Hawaii is the least white state in the nation. So how exactly is that a white state? So it just goes to show you that they use the whiteness attack as a means of discrediting his ideas, because they basically, they don't just want to discredit Bernie Sanders. They want to attack social democracy as a whole and basically say that, well, if you support social democracy over identity-related issues, you're an evil, privileged white male. So shut up about it.
Well, with the sort of breakup of the conservative coalition I talked about, I'd say on the left, the Democratic Party at least, there's basically three core groups. There is sort of the ethnic identity interests like Black Lives Matter and Hispanic interest groups. There is people who vote for Bernie Sanders who care a lot about the issues of sort of economic justice issues, people who are anti-capitalist. Then you have people who are well off, kind of neoliberal economically, and socially liberal. So I'd say basically on the Democratic Party, it's sort of basically a coalition of three groups that sometimes overlap with each other. Barry Guy, would you say that's about accurate, or would you say there's sort of more of a two-way civil war?
I think that that's reasonably accurate. And one interesting, it's interesting you mentioned this, these affluent, socially liberal or neoliberal types, because Thomas Frank, the author who wrote the book What's the Matter with Kansas, which is basically gospel to liberals when it comes to explaining why working class whites vote Republican, he recently came out with a new book called Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And what he essentially argues is that the Democratic Party has transitioned from being the party of the worker to the party of the affluent coastal professional types, people in places like SF. And so basically they're the primary people that the Democrats care about, and various groups such as blacks and Latinos, they mainly vote Democrat because they're captive constituencies. They're not going to vote Republican, so Democrats can kind of take them for granted.
And also the Democratic Party has a better threshold on, like, the culture, because those affluent, socially liberal types essentially dictate our culture. So a lot of people live in those realms. And I've noticed this in the last couple of years, you know, people are starting to, you know, go to Whole Foods and they want to expand their tastes and what the clothes they wear. There's sort of this, like, hipster meme that it's sort of like we've already passed it. Like, we've hit peak hipster. And, you know, that's really the Democratic Party. Like, you know, it's so silly. It's like I looked at Obama's use of Gotham font in 2008. And, you know, because that was like the cool sort of hip font of the time. And the fact that, like, his like, you know, Hope and Change were written like that, I think it was just, you know, to appeal to these people that wanted something new, hip and fresh. But I think that's beyond us now.
So,
yeah.
Barry Guy, you linked to that article by Steve Saylor I wrote about. So you linked to that article I sent you by Steve of San Francisco, and he titled San Francisco's Whitening Plan, which is kind of what's ironic about this is San Francisco has traditionally been one of the most leftist cities in the country. But basically what's happening now is because the prices are so high that a lot of non-whites are being basically priced out of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's actually, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek. I don't know if there's like some official whitening plan, but it's just kind of ironic and amusing.
Well, what's interesting is that this isn't exactly confined to SF, because various cities such as Oakland have also lost their black populations via gentrification. So there's sort of been this overall demographic shift. But what makes SF interesting is that you mentioned that it's very left-wing, but I don't think it's quite left-wing in the same way that, say, Seattle or Portland is left-wing. SF has always had more of a live-and-let-live kind of liberalism as opposed to the aggressive SJW antics that you might witness in Portland. But SF has really sort of changed from its bohemian image to becoming basically a technocratic city. And there are a lot of business school graduates and young entrepreneurs and various other neoliberal technocrat types who think they can dictate what is best to everyone else. And this is understandably produce the clash.
Do the technocrats bring SJW-ness with them?
Not so much. They tend to be socially liberal, but ultimately they're there to get paid. So it's not really passion for them, but they tend to go along with the prevailing politically correct trends.
I mean, you're relatively young. Have you noticed a lot of these trends and changes even within your lifetime?
I definitely have. When I go to SF, it does seem to be more gentrified. And I remember when I was in middle school, we took a field trip to the Mission, which was still heavily Latino at the time and very much had a Latino flavor. But if you go to neighborhoods like the Mission now, there are many white hipster bars that you can find. So there has definitely been a very significant change.
It's ironic that the people that are most concerned about the welfare of, like, minorities are the people who gentrify their neighborhoods and, like, remove them. So
well,
maybe they just have guilt
they
over
care
doing
about
that,
minorities. Well, they care about minorities in the abstract. I don't think they actually care so much about
them. In theory, not in practice.
Exactly.
Well, Paul Gottfried says that for them, they're sacred objects. So it's probably just in their religion.
Well, I think for many white liberals, non-whites are sort of their way of showing up white conservatives and working class types, because I don't want to derail this back into a discussion about Trump. The one thing I've noticed is that his campaign has basically been an excuse for many liberal journalists to bash working class whites as these ignorant, backward racists. And some people on the socialist left, since I follow that scene a bit, they've been sort of pointing out the classism and saying that this is really just an excuse to attack poor people. So I think for many liberal whites, it's really poor white people that they're trying to put down. They sort of use their enlightened support for minorities as a means of doing so.
Did you see Kevin Williamson's article in National Review that mirrored what you said?
I did.
The white working class needs to just die. I mean, because I'm from New Jersey, so the part that said, like, it's not, these people's lives are not Bruce Springsteen songs, they're just, like, waste, was really offensive to me. It was like, I felt like he was writing about me. It was terrible.
And then these people,
like, really brutal.
Rank and file Republicans are abandoning them.
Yeah, exactly. Like, who is gonna? What kind of conservative will read that and nod their head? Like, who are they? I think they're pandering to liberals and trying to get them onto the neoconservative side, outside of being neoliberal.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're basically pandering to wealthy, affluent Republicans, and including one of my friends who said he's going to vote for Hillary Clinton over Trump, and he's a Orange County, basically a Rockefeller Republican type. Many times during conversations with my dad and other relatives, today's Bay Area liberals are in many ways yesterday's Rockefeller Republicans.
Because that's originally, the Bay Area was sort of a Rockefeller Republican stronghold. Even as recently as the 70s, there were a lot of, like, liberal Republicans in that area. And it was, so you saw that kind of a political realignment in the same way that you saw with wealthy Rockefeller Republicans in the Northeast.
Well, I remember another article Steve Saylor wrote about San Francisco basically said that the Bay Area was settled more by these Puritan types, whereas Southern California was settled by more live and let live libertarian types. And so that culture sort of influenced the development of the respective regions. And so the Bay Area definitely has that Puritan Protestant work ethic, pull yourself up by your bootstraps ethos.
I know the article you're talking about. Like, one of the issues he made is because, like, the Bay Area, they kind of put more restrictions on the housing supply, and that put prices up. Well, originally, Southern California, one of the reasons was they pretty much had a pretty laissez-faire attitude towards development, but Southern California is definitely, it's getting pretty expensive too, not to the degree of San Francisco. But San Francisco sort of does have definitely, like, higher aesthetic standards. I mean, a lot of places, like, you look at it somewhere like Orange County, it's expensive, but it's also kind of an, it's gotten a lot of the cities are pretty ugly too.
Yep, it's just strip mall after strip mall.
So with these housing prices, I mean, there's political agendas, but a lot of it is just sort of supply and demand. Geographically, San Francisco is very restrained because you have a bay there, and then it's surrounded by mountain ranges. So you have this very narrow strip of land, as opposed to Southern California, which was built on this big plain. So there's a lot of geographical restraints which drive up housing prices. And the other thing, as I kind of mentioned, is because San Francisco is one of the few cities that kind of has that kind of historic charm that you might imagine that a European city would have, and a lot of most American cities don't really have that. So that also drives up the demand. So there's a lot of different factors why the city is so expensive.
Well, for all of SF's faults, it has done a remarkable job at preserving its nature in terms of the environment, and it has also preserved many local restaurants and businesses. But of course, if you're a struggling tenant who has to contend with rising rents and faces the looming threat of eviction, well, that might be cold comfort. So it's really a clash of values and sort of a debate over what kinds of trade-offs people are willing to make or want to make.
A lot of like mainstream conservatives, they'll make the case that in order they'll say you need to sort of allow unlimited growth if you want to keep housing affordable. I don't agree with them, but that's the argument that they would make.
Well, I don't agree with them either, and I don't think that growth for its own sake is necessarily good, because that interview you did with Ron Unz, he did make a very compelling case against excessive population growth and how it's basically reduced Californians' standard of living. So I think that there should be some limits on population growth and new housing to an extent.
Well, that has to deal entirely with immigration, the overpopulation.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at California,
yeah, exactly.
That's the main driving force of population in California. If you remove that from the equation, the number of American-born citizens is pretty much stabilized in California.
Right, but good luck trying to remove that and put the genie back in the bottle. It's basically politically unfeasible at this point.
What do you think about that group that was referenced in that article? They're called BARF, which stands for Bay Area Renters Federation. And they're actually like going around suing cities to allow for increased density as a way to increase housing supply, because with this debate about development, it kind of creates another civil war on the left, because you have this one – you have people in the Bay Area who want like zero new development, and – their argument is they see development as harming their quality of life, but a lot of these people are people who are already they already own their single family homes and they're well off. And you have a lot of like young people who can't, obviously they're not going to be able to afford to buy a home. So there's this movement which is advocating for increasing density. And that there's sort of this debate about what to do with increasing housing supply. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I actually am familiar with the organization, and I read a New York Times profile about the woman behind it. I believe her name's something Taub. I forget her name. But basically, a lot of these people involved with BARF, they're not exactly your average working people just trying to catch a break. What's happened is that there's a lot of these young tech workers who are making decent salaries and who are definitely doing better than the average American. It's just that SF has become so obscenely expensive that if you didn't get in earlier, then even if you are relatively affluent, it's going to be hard to buy a home or rent an apartment. So I can certainly understand why native SF residents have reservations about letting these new yuppies
come in, because while it would improve the mobility, sort of the social mobility of these young tech workers and entrepreneur types, it would also drive up, basically make SF even more Hobbesian than it already is in terms of competition for living space.
Well, do you think they need to increase the housing supply? If so, is that feasible?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily so much increasing the housing supply, but I don't want to go off on a tangent too much. Because I've been reading this book by Michael Hunton, an author on The Huns Review, by the way. He wrote a book called Killing the Host. And one of the major
themes of that book is this idea of economic rent and an economy dominated by the FIRE sector, FIRE standing for finance, insurance, and real estate. And what he essentially argues in the book is that owners of real estate, landlords, and other property classes basically make way more income than they actually deserve. So I think that while supply and demand plays a role, I think that SF's landlords and other rich people also reap a lot of rewards from economic rent, just using their leverage and their power to charge prices that are unnecessary.
I've read Saylor's ideas on this a couple times. I think part of what he said was that the reason why some of these housing bubbles occur is because loans are given to families that, the banks know that they can't pay them back. And he said a lot of it has to do with it's a demographic issue. It's like these immigrant families are given loans and can't pay, they can't pay them back. What do you guys think about that?
Well, ultimately, I think that it takes two to tango, because I know that a lot of people on the alt-right want to blame a bunch of ignorant and irresponsible Black and Latino homeowners for the recession. But at the same time, you had this major industry in the United States constantly touting the benefits of homeownership. And even during the height of the subprime binge, Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, he encouraged yet more homeownership, and they're constantly promoting this notion that owning your own home makes you wealthy, it's living the American dream. So for people
that is the American dream, to own a home, essentially.
So ultimately, I don't really blame Blacks and Latinos for wanting to get in on the action. Ultimately, I think the banks are responsible.
And, the banks are driving up real estate. That's absolutely true. And then there's the whole issue with the landlords. But supply and demand is still a huge factor, especially in desirable areas.
Of course.
I mean, that still needs to be addressed. Even if we fix the banking system, it wouldn't make everything become like magically affordable. We'd still have these issues. I mean, is it geographically, is it feasible to increase the housing supply in places like California?
Well, it's feasible, but like I said, there would be trade-offs. The environment would suffer. There would be a...
Your standard of living overall would decline because more people are cramped in together. Then it definitely makes for a lower quality of life.
Why can't you just make something like the walled city in China? Like a housing complex
city?
That fits. Yeah. Like a housing complex that just fits 50,000 people in it. That's the,
well, I mean,
the solution.
Alex, you're near Manhattan. mm-hmm. Which is probably the most crowded place in America. What are your thoughts
on that
kind of living?
I mean, the thing is, it's like when I'm hearing you guys talk about this stuff, I live in such a densely populated area that it's almost something I don't think about. When I go to New York, it's so loud and there's so much movement that it actually feels like I have space out here in suburban New Jersey that, you know, compared to, you know, time I've spent out in Pennsylvania or upstate New York is incredibly cramped. So I feel like my anything I have to say on this topic is marred by the fact that I've really gotten used to living in a very, very cramped area. It's kind of the only life I've known.
Yeah, maybe people just have to embrace your attitude.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't known it any other way. So
it's not just the density of a city; it's also like the quality of planning, the quality of the culture, and the quality of the aesthetics of a city.
Yeah, I think those are all really important, especially in New York, because even though it is very, very, very cramped, as our culture has become more homogenized overall, like there's less of an alternative culture that really exists, but you can still go to New York and spend time and kind of DIY sort of venue. I mean, even though that stuff is all like leftized, but you can go to a city like New York and sort of find niche cultures and ignore the basically you live in a bubble and you ignore the kind of Mad Max hellhole that exists around you.
And when it comes down to it, I mean, most people would rather visit somewhere like a London, New York, San Francisco, than like a spread out sort of a sunbelt city like Dallas.
Well, I mean, yeah, but at the same time, it's like I think they want to visit those cities based on their like historical interpretation of them. I mean,
well, that's true.
I feel like there's been many people I know who like are like, oh, I'm going to Europe, and then they tell me, oh yeah, where'd you go? And I ask them if they went to London, and they always, you know, these are people that are fairly liberal. And they'll tell me, oh, yeah, London, I don't know, it's weird. It's not good. You know, they don't really go into, they don't really talk about it. But they'll just tell me it's not good or it's weird. So
I guess speaking, since we've kind of, you mentioned London, I guess I wanted to bring up the fact that, so London now has a Muslim mayor. And
but
that is
calm, yep.
He's elected, but pretty just purely from a symbolic standpoint, this is a big deal because when there's been smaller cities in Europe, like I think Rotterdam in the Netherlands, but London's a city that's always been seen as kind of the pinnacle of Western civilization. So this just has a huge sort of a psychological impact. Muslims throughout Europe will feel a strong sense of feeling kind of empowered. I know the iconic sort of a red double-decker buses are now, they have this sign up that says, Praise Allah. So this is a really historic event in so many ways.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was talking to go ahead.
Well, what's interesting is that Sadiq Khan is, I sort of see him as another kind of identitarian neoliberal type because one
like
of the
Obama.
Things he did exactly because he sort of highlights his background as the son of a cab driver, I believe, and he sort of brands himself as this inspirational transcender who breaks down barriers and overcomes adversity. But he also has attacked the more left-wing elements of labor. He's in many ways criticized the Jeremy Corbyn style of leadership and talked about building a big tent. Reminds me a lot of Obama's whole hope and change, you know, we're all Americans, we can all come together, which of
have
course
you
is
read,
nonsense.
Yeah. Have you read Steve Saylor's book on Obama, The Half-Blood Prince?
I've read the Harry Potter book of the same name, but no.
Yeah, he knows Saylor. Like, I, you know, he's just always trying to be quirky in some way. Oh, I mean, his writing on Obama is amazing. There's this article called Obama's Lame Taste in Music. I don't know if you guys have read that one. He basically explains, like, he's like, there were so many great bands in Southern California during the early 80s, and in Chicago as well. How could Barack Obama be listening to Bob Marley when you had the Go-Go's? And, like, I don't know. But the funny thing is about Half-Blood Prince is, you know, it really, really shows you. I mean, because, you know, Sandler's like a meticulous writer. And he shows, you know, the reader how much of an identitarian Barack Obama is. And even beyond an identitarian, like how much of a racialist he is. And how much he thinks about race, I think, in some kind of, like, biological way.
We take it for granted that visible minorities, especially blacks, are going to be race conscious. So that doesn't really surprise me. And that's only compounded by the fact that Obama is not really your typical black person. And so in many ways, I think he had to overcompensate.
That's what I think about the whole Reverend Wright thing. Like, conservatives made a big deal about it, and yeah, I mean, there's a massive double standard, but I think he did that more to get, like, street cred when he was running for office
in the south side of Chicago. Yeah, but he was an active member of Wright's church, and Oprah Winfrey, she left the church before Barack left. And, you know, because of Wright's rhetoric, you know, she just didn't want to be associated with that. And someone asked, some journalist asked a member of Barack Obama's campaign in, like, 08, why Obama stayed. And it was something like, I guess he didn't feel black enough. So I feel like it was a confirmation of his own identity. It was a way he sort of found himself.
Because he's overcompensating because he – I mean, culturally, in a lot of ways, he's like kind of like a white Swipple. And you see the same kind of thing in the California Senate race. I wanted to get to this since we interviewed Ron Unz. But with the Democrats, you have two candidates. The Democratic frontrunner, Kamala Harris, her background, she is sort of like Obama in some ways. Her background is her dad, I think, is Jamaican, and her mom is from an East Indian background. But culturally, she pretty much kind of represents, like, basically, like, she's sort of like this white liberal Swipple candidate. And then Loretta Sanchez, who is another Democrat, is very big into kind of a Mexican identity politics or Mexican-American identity politics. But what is interesting about Loretta Sanchez is she's gotten some flack for making, like, insensitive comments about Muslims and also about the Vietnamese.
What's interesting is that I looked into Loretta Sanchez's background, and she's sort of trying to position herself as the Bernie Sanders of California in a way, because Kamala Harris has been sort of attacked as an establishment shill, and I know that Sanchez gave her grief for being slow to embrace a $15 minimum wage, and Sanchez frequently touts her experience serving on the Armed Services Committee, or I forget the exact name, and she also brags about her son who's in the Army, and so she's sort of trying to portray herself as a kind of tough fighter who will fight on behalf of average Californians as opposed to people like Harris who are just the average wine and cheese establishment liberal types.
Would you view her as the lesser of two evils, Sanchez?
Yes, I would. And one more comment I'll make about Sanchez for now is that she has also sort of demonstrated how American politics has significantly changed, because while people, when she was taken to task for those offensive statements you made, I believe she sort of disavowed some of the specifics, but at the same time, she refused to apologize for her colorful personality. And I think that more and more colorful personalities are on their way.
So we interviewed Ron Unz, and on the Republican side, you basically have three candidates. The other ones are not really that worth talking about, but one of them is like an establishment type, similar to like a Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the other one is more like kind of a Ted Cruz type. Ron Unz is really one of the most fascinating people in politics because he doesn't fit into any kind of political niche. When I interviewed him, I kind of looked over his platform and I kind of told him, like, your platform sounds like combining some of like the best ideas of Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and a little bit of Ron Paul. So maybe he's listening to the show, or maybe maybe that's just the direction things are going in. People are beginning.
Yeah, I think he's influenced by us.
Well, if you look at his own site, The Unz Review, he basically has features. His site features an eclectic mix of various bloggers. You have nationalists and pseudo-alt writers such as Steve Saylor and Pat Buchanan on the one hand, and then you have Gustavo Arellano, the Ask a Mexican guy, who's more left-wing and anti-whites, and you also have the work of Mike Whitney, James Petras. So I think that Unz in many ways is a radical centrist, and the old ideological labels don't really matter as much anymore. So it's both him and it's the changing culture.
And I think that Unz obviously doesn't agree with everyone he posts on his site. I mean, there's no way someone could agree with all of these people. And I think it's sort of, you know, a testament, sort of his testament to free speech, and that almost everyone that writes for Unz.com is someone who has been kicked off of another platform. So I just view it as like a sanctuary.
It's a place where all non-mainstream perspectives gather.
And I think as far as candidates, there really hasn't really been that many radical centrist type candidates. I mean, the only one I can think of would be like Ross Perot.
What about Nader?
I see him as far left.
I guess what we said on our, I think on our show we said kind of like combining like the aspects of Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan. So I guess out of everyone, Ron Unz is probably like the closest. If you look over his platform, you see like raising the minimum wage, you see taxing Wall Street, you see immigration reduction, you see cheaper college tuition. So just sort of putting all these issues together, I think this type of a movement, I think it would have be very popular. It's just most people feel that if they want to get elected into a certain political party, they have to take sort of generic conservative or generic liberal stances. And even with Trump, I mean, Trump is far from he's far from ideal, but I think also the Trump campaign is playing a role as well in sort of pushing things in that direction. But even Unz, I know,
right,
he sort of said that he's not a big fan of Trump. He still acknowledges sort of the appeal of him. But which I think someone like Unz also, if he was more widespread, if he got more widespread support, I think he would have a broader appeal to people who are more sort of well-educated, like Swipple types, than I think Trump does. But it would be interesting to see if Ron Unz can do the next round and just sort of contrast support in California for Unz and support for Trump, and just sort of analyze who does better and among which demographic.
Well, I think the paradox is that in order to win primary types of elections, you sort of have to lose the general, because going back to Trump, all the polls have indicated that his former rivals such as John Kasich would have actually performed better in a general election since he's more moderate. But in order to galvanize your base and in order to inspire their passions, you have to play the role of a fighter, of a maverick that might end up alienating more people down the road. And I think for Ron Unz, he sort of lacks Trump's fire and initial appeal. But if he were to progress beyond the initial round, I think that his intellect and his ideological flexibility would enable him to perhaps build a bigger coalition.
Yeah, it seems like Trump just moved himself really outside of the Overton window, or at least the Republican Party, and they couldn't catch up with him. And that was his method of defeating them. And now that he's defeated them, he can essentially move beyond those ideas. But it's kind of like the attack mode of, it's like the art of the deal. Like, present the most insane, over-the-top thing first, and then everyone gets scared, and they're like, oh, my God, like, there's the threat of this guy who's totally unpredictable. So, like, let's compromise with him. And then once you compromise, you actually reach a middle ground, but he feels like he wins because he's the guy. So, like, everything Trump does is all marketing. It's all from his, like, you know, business career. And the fact that people don't pick up on that is absolutely ridiculous. Like, I think you have to view him like a guy, like, who's trying to get a job more than someone who's running for office.
That's an excellent point. And whether you're applying for a job or running for office, I think in many ways the two have sadly become the same, because in today's society it's all about how you market yourself, your brand. Again, it's very neoliberal, this obsession with identity and, you know, what you bring to the table, like you're a product or something.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, the Trump brand has definitely transcended Trump. I heard that there was a protest in Hungary about, you know, anti-immigration protest. The people in Hungary were protesting against immigration, and they were chanting Trump. You know, to Viktor Orban, they're chanting Trump. So it's just like, I feel like, you know, he's just made, like, Trump has replaced nationalist.
Right,
maybe even
that,
in a worldwide sense.
I actually read an article about how a Hindu nationalist group in India called the Hindu Sena basically endorsed Trump and praised him, saying that he's the only one who can fight Islamic terror and end this cancer. So,
yeah.
It really is like a product in many ways.
Yeah, it's like a product that gets rid of jihadis. You buy Trump, and then you're like, oh, I buy Trump, and it makes me rich and gets rid of jihadis.
Indeed.
We're getting kind of towards the end of the show. Is there anything about any of these topics, I guess, kind of to summarize all these different topics? I guess we went on kind of a lot of different tangents. We didn't really focus on, like, one theme, but I guess to kind of summarize the show would be good way to sum it up.
I think that the one thing to take away from this show is that we should make another call to embrace radical centrism, because when Ron Unz advocated raising the minimum wage as a means to decrease illegal immigration, I think that his reasoning was spot on, because he said that, look, the only reason why these illegal immigrants come and take these jobs is because they're the only ones desperate enough to work for lousy wages. So you raise the wage and that will deter employers. And also, if employers are caught violating minimum wage laws, then people will be a lot more unsympathetic and willing to bring them to heel than they will to deport these poor, innocent brown people. So I remember Hunter Wallace of Occidental Dissent reviewed Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, and he basically said that the right thing in politics is often done for the wrong reason. And I know that a lot of alt-righters want to reduce immigration for nationalist reasons, but if raising the minimum wage is a means to reduce immigration, then I say we embrace it.
Well, yeah, I think the thing about being a radical centrist, it really means that you take any issue and you look at it and you weigh the pros and the cons. And if the pros outweigh the cons, then we will probably support it. We're not so tied to these kind of, because I think we understand that, like, the left has a utopian dream that is flawed, and the right's dream of, like, returning to the glory of the past is also flawed, because that glorious past, like, never existed. So what we do is, like, we understand, like, reality, and we just take things, like, objectively and try to do the best from what we see.
Right, and whenever I read something written by anyone, regardless of their ideological background, even if I generally disagree with them, and if they have something of value to say, then I will definitely take that into account.
Yeah, I think we just try to reduce the echo chamber and try to go to a place that's just free-for-all open-mindedness.
And that's kind of why UndReview, I think, is the perfect example of that, because it just provides a sort of platform for views that are outside of the mainstream and views that sometimes some articles in there might contradict themselves, but that's fine because then people can read different articles, come to their own conclusions.
Yeah.
There's so many interesting and excellent sites there on kind of like the alt-right sphere and kind of the neo-reaction, but I read those sites and it just sort of feels totally like an echo chamber. I mean, they're great sites, but they're basically speaking to their sort of niche audience.
Well, they live in their own kind of universe and where there's rules and morals and laws. And while that place is incredibly interesting and there's a huge wealth of knowledge, in order to apply any of that to the real world, we're going to have to do it in a way that makes sense to people. And
exactly.
I don't really know if these high-end, like, new right ideas, like, you know, you're not going to walk up to some guy on the street and start talking to him about, you know, like, Alain de Benoist and Greco-Roman paganism. You know, like these things are great. Like, I love them. But at the same time, it's like, you know, like, hey, we should hire the minimum wage in order to make this work for all of us. It's probably, you know, the radical center is actually doing things. It's about actually doing things rather than creating an idea space. Essentially, that's what they do.
Yeah,
well, writers.
We're basically doing things rather than getting brownie points for ideological purity.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, okay, this guy said Jews aren't white. Good, he gets 3 points. You know?
And I think, Barry, a guy you were even saying, like, to avoid, you think it's better off avoiding these sort of alt-right buzzwords like cultural Marxism?
Right. Well, at least in the initial stages, because one thing I've observed in the Bay Area is that very few people subscribe to these internet-style politics. So despite the fact that the Bay Area is renowned for being a liberal left-wing region, I have yet to encounter anyone who really uses terms like privilege or mansplaining or any of these social justice buzzwords.
The SJW terms, no.
Yeah.
And the
I
only
mean,
person
I think,
have encountered
yeah.
well,
who
they,
does
they do
went
on
to
the
university.
Internet. You hear it, yeah, you hear it maybe in clubs and universities, some college professors, but it's kind of the same thing. And I think with social justice warriors, I also think there's kind of a divide because you have two types of social justice warrior types. You have the people who are, they're basically people who are unemployed or working kind of low-wage jobs, and they're frustrated and they kind of latch on to that kind of social justice warrior politics as a way to feel that they're fighting against something, fighting for a cause, and they feel kind of an emptiness in their own lives. And those are a lot of the people you saw, like a lot of the protesters who were protesting against Trump. And there's people who are sort of well off, and they just sort of support the social justice talking points as a way to sort of signal status. So I think even within the social justice movement, there's a divide for different types who get into it.
It's funny, though, because that first camp of social justice warriors, the ones that people like us talk about and we make fun of them for their triggering and all of that, these people are very, very reactionary, and they have a good hold on semantics, and they're also well-organized. So the minute that we start calling them SJWs, they distance themselves from that label. And then when we start talking about things like triggering and PTSD, they distance themselves from those labels. Like the force of the kind of radical liberalism that controls them is like totally mutable. And I think that's like the most dangerous side of these people is that, you know, they're totally doing this based on like virtue signaling because of their own nihilism and weakness. I'm like too Nietzschean about this stuff. But like, you know, so like they're going to constantly change the name of their game and the way they go about things, because they're very well aware that people like us are criticizing them, and they know our criticism is valid.
And I also think a lot of like alt-right types, they put all their energy into fighting like these social justice warrior types, when really they're just being used as a pawns.
Yeah,
the NGOs are. Yeah,
that's why I'm advocating more of an economic approach, because yes, SJWs are annoying, but I think it's more important to go after their enablers, who are these affluent media and academic types.
Well, Jonathan Bowden said that, you know, these types, the kind of Antifa social justice warriors, they're the strong arm of the establishment. They're like this the brown shirts or the street fighting men of the establishment who will go out and beat you up for saying the wrong thing, and the government doesn't have to.
Exactly.
So we're basically out of time. I'd like to thank Barry Guy and Alex von Goldstein for being on.
Yeah, and thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to engage in these conversations.
Yeah, it's great
again
to talk to you guys, and I hope to speak to you again, Bay Area Guy.
To you as well.
Thanks again. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.